the cello offers the closest instrumental imitation of the human voice.
If you were to ask most music lovers the question, who were the greatest cellists in history? Certain names would immediately trip off the tongue. Pablo Casals, Pierre Fournier, Paul Tourtellier, Mstislav Rostropovich, Jacqueline Dupré. All technical masters, and all in their own individual ways, flamboyant characters, whose names will always be remembered, and quite rightly so. But today I would like to remember and celebrate four cellists that history seems to have forgotten. They all enjoyed celebrated reputations while they were alive, all of them had successful recording careers, and they produced an exquisite sound that at least equaled their more renowned counterparts. And all four bequeathed a remarkable musical legacy. Yet the names Felix Salmond, Miros Sadlo, Antonio Yanigro, and Leonard Rose have largely faded from public consciousness. In this programme, I not only want to celebrate these remarkable players' places in musical history, but I want to try to understand why they've been forgotten. I'll be exploring their careers, their techniques, their unique sound, and also their legacies.
One of the interesting things about the four cellists is that they actually, in many ways, represent four different styles.
Yes. Leonard Rose is really the dean of American cellists. His sound, very compact, very focused, and very intense.
You have Salmond, who's a very English, perhaps slightly contained player, with a lovely, noble sound.
Miros Sadlo developed into one of the most significant Czech cellists in both solo and chamber spheres, really.
What I always think of with Sadlo is that he was such a wonderful colourist. You hear this wonderful sound, and he somehow sang so beautifully on the cello. Certainly Sadlo was quite amazingly gifted in that way. And a pupil of his said that he had these huge hands, but they were as soft as a mushroom. And all these things help with the tone, don't they?
Yanigro in Zagreb, he founded the School of Modern Cello Playing in Yugoslavia. And, of course, as a player, he was a soloist of the highest repute.
He's a very athletic player, I think. Very sort of... He looked a bit like a hawk. So slim and swarthy and... Somehow that comes out in his playing, I think, that his playing is very... It's a sort of thin man's kind of playing somehow.
In 1963, Rostropovich described the cello as a hero. And if the cello is indeed a hero, then I would describe Salmond, Sadlo, Yanigro and Rose as the unsung heroes of this most eloquent of instruments. Cello playing developed in leaps and bounds throughout the 20th century, with distinct styles emerging in different countries. The first of my four neglected cellists is the Englishman Felix Salmond. Grieg's To Spring, played by Salmond, truly one of my favourite cello recordings. One of the great challenges for any musician is to touch the hearts of their audience, especially through the medium of recording. It's one of the great tests, and Salmond passes with flying colours. His tone is crystal clear, and his extensive rubato is perfectly judged. Felix Salmond was born in 1888, and just 4 years after starting to play the cello, had won a scholarship to the Royal Academy of Music, before moving on to Brussels Conservatoire. Music historian Tully Potter.
I think that cello playing, certainly in Salmond's time, was evolving virtually every week.
Yes.
And he came from a very, very musical family.
Yes.
Father a singer, mother a very good pianist, who actually launched his career. All his early performances were given with her. His father was a baritone, and I think that if you come out of a singing family, maybe singing on the cello comes naturally.
That's one of the things I feel most about him, is that he speaks very directly, very clearly through the cello, doesn't he? And he had a wonderful, focused singing sound, I think.
Salmond possibly had rather fat fingers, people said, which probably helped with the tone, but not necessarily with leaping around the cello.
Yes.
But we know so much more now about the capabilities of instruments. Remember that, I mean, the sort of sound being made by most cellists, and probably by Salmond in his young days, was probably quite a miserable sound.
How do you get the sound of the cello past an orchestra, past a piano?
Conductor and cellist Kenneth Woods.
And Salmond seemed to find a way that was really to do with the focus, the energized relationship of the bow and the string, and using the vibrato to spin the sound forward and project it.
Age 20, Salmond made his concert debut at the Bechstein Hall, playing in Frank Bridges' Fantasy Trio in C minor and Brahms' G minor piano quartet. He described the cello as par excellence the great singer and poet of the trio, unequalled in its variety and range of tone colour, and in its capacity to express music of nobility, tenderness, and declamation. As we can hear now in Salmond's performance of A Little Siciliana by Pergolesi.
Thank you.
Salmon's burgeoning international career was interrupted by the outbreak of the First World War. But it was in 1919 that a now infamous performance threatened to derail it completely. Professor Robin Stowell.
His reputation in Britain was soiled rather by the episode surrounding the premiere of Elgar's cello concerto, where the lack of rehearsal time led to the performance being panned by the critics. And I think he never actually overcame that humiliation, and maybe one reason why he emigrated to the USA. After his emigration to the USA, he was a central figure in cello pedagogy and incredibly influential, positively and negatively perhaps, on future generations of players.
His impact as a teacher in America was extraordinary. He taught this incredible generation of cellist pedagogues. Leonard Rose, Bernard Greenhouse, all had great playing careers, but all could teach. And I think that reflects well on Salmon, because to teach someone to articulate what you've given them as a teacher is an extra gift, and not everyone has it. His playing has a sort of classical directness. It's very eloquent and very expressive and very moving, but it's not sentimental, and it doesn't wallow and it doesn't bellow, but it's moving. And I think it's moving because of the sort of simplicity with which he plays. And his students, like Greenhouse and Rose, they all seem to have gotten that from him.
Salmon had indeed passed on his passion for music to his illustrious pupils. Here's Salmon at his disciplined best in an extremely rare recording from Beethoven's Cello Sonata in A with pianist Simeon Rumchisky. Wonderful playing, and for me it's Salmon's unrivalled sound that resonates across the decades. He's stylistically very aware. Just listen to how he varies his sound from composer to composer, adopting a wonderful lightness of touch in this Debussy minuet. Just a child when Salmon was at his peak, Miloš Sadlo is another great cellist who has sadly faded from history. Known as the Czech Casals, he was born Miloš Savitsky in 1912 Prague, the illegitimate child of an impoverished family. Age 15, he met the inspirational pedagogue Karel Sadlo, whose name he took. Sadlo would practice for up to 10 hours a day, and extraordinarily, in just 3 years, he had played both the Dvořák and Rydke concertos with the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra. In 1932, he announced his arrival on the world stage by winning the Vienna cello competition. How would you describe the style of Sadlo?
He somehow sang so beautifully on the cello.
Yes.
Our own Albert Sammons used to use the word stretchy, but somehow this wonderful way of being able to play a long note without it sagging and But I think that Sadlo had this amazing feeling for sound and letting it really sing, yes, and also to colour it in unusual ways.
In 1947, Sadlo was invited to play and record Dmitri Shostakovich's E minor piano trio, with David Oistrakh as violinist and a notoriously impatient Shostakovich himself on the piano. Tully Potter again.
And Shostakovich would only do one take, so Sadlo had to get that right the first time. And funnily enough, they'd already gone the previous year with the Czech trio that Sadlo played in, to play the work to Shostakovich, and Shostakovich said, oh, no, that's all wrong and that's wrong and that's wrong. But in fact, then asked him the following year to play it with him, so something obviously clicked. The cello comes in over the top of the violin, yes, with the harmonics, and he just gets it right. I think he said to me something like, well, I was younger then and I had lots of nerve.
Sadlo with David Oistrakh and Dmitri Shostakovich playing the opening of Shostakovich's piano trio. After 15 years as a member of the Czech trio, Sadlo left it to develop his career still further as a soloist. But it was in 1962 that Sadlo had the biggest success of his career. Oldřich Pulkert, the archivist at the Prague National Museum, discovered a lost cello concerto by no less than Joseph Haydn. As the leading Czech cellist, Sadlo was the obvious man to bring this masterpiece back to life, which he did at the Prague Spring Festival in May 1962, going on to make the world premiere recording, which was released the following year. This was a major coup for Sadlo, as music lovers all over the world rushed to buy it. Sadly, Sadlo's brief moment in the spotlight was soon eclipsed by none other than Mstislav Rostropovich. The following year, Rostropovich released his own version of the Haydn Concerto.
Well, I think everyone was just knocked out and they wanted to capitalise on Rostropovich's enormous éclat, really. But to be honest, I mean, Sadlo at that point would have done it better, and I think he was probably a better interpreter of the work.
Rostropovich's version was slicker and more obviously virtuosic than the cultured Miloš Sadlo, and it was Rostropovich's version that etched itself into the public consciousness. Kenneth Woods again.
In the last 40 years, you hear a lot of cellists, you know, in the sort of post-Rostropovich era, who play with very, very big, hugely resonant sound with a vibrato that's kind of deep and wide and designed to get the sound open and big and projecting. And Sadlo, his sound is, it's hard to describe this, but I think more aristocratic. He played with what would be, by modern standards, a very fast vibrato. But rather than giving the sound an unpleasant sort of nervous quality, it gives it a sort of real brilliance, and it also helps the sound to project without sounding effortful. he's able to speak with the clarity that other cellists shout. With a sort of sense of focused intensity and directness, he's able to really come through the orchestra and to project while keeping the sort of intimacy.
Politics conspired against greater world renown for Sadlow. Events during the Prague Spring forced him to return from America to his family. It could also be that Sadlow spread himself too thinly, at the expense of achieving enduring recognition as a soloist. A great ambassador for both the instrument and its repertoire, as is my next unsung hero of the cello, Antonio Yanigro. Born in Milan in 1918, Yanigro would become one of Italy's finest ever instrumentalists in a country which was obsessed by opera.
Instrumental music was totally neglected. After the death of Paganini, there were very few instrumentalists and string players in particular. But then there was a whole generation of wonderful teachers who emerged sort of around the turn of the century, and among them were three amazing brothers called Crepax. And Yanigro, again, came from an amazingly musical family. His father was a terrific pianist who'd had his arm shattered by a bullet in the First World War, so couldn't continue his career. And his mother was a pianist and so on. And he sort of started in a quite a desultory way on the cello. A family friend started him. And then he went to Gilberto Crepax, who was the lead cellist at La Scala. And eventually he went to Paris. Yanigro, I think, just flourished in Paris. So he's very interesting, coming from the Italian school and then picking up on the French school, both schools really interested in tone production.
As a teenager, Yanigro's mother Maria's tireless efforts secured him an audition with Pablo Casals, who described him as a brilliant instrumentalist with a fine sense of style. He should become a shining exponent of our chosen instrument. These were prophetic words, for after graduating from L'École Normale in 1937, Yanigro soon embarked on a successful solo career, due partly to a chance encounter on a train.
Early in his career, Yanigro did an awful lot of travelling back and forth between Milan and Paris by rail.
Professor Robin Stowell.
And he would always search for an empty compartment so that he could practice his cello. Once, while practicing, the door to his compartment opened, and as chance would have it, a music agent appeared, like a fairy godmother. And what materialised was a number of concerts for Yanigro in France in later months.
Yanigro's consummate technique is clearly evident in this recording of the last movement of Haydn's D major concerto, to which he brought a winning mixture of charm, taste, and vivacity. The chain-smoking Unigro was renowned for his dedicated working rituals. He would practice scales and arpeggios for hours, and he developed a fantastic bowing arm. At the start of the Second World War, Unigro was holidaying in Yugoslavia, and he became trapped there. But perhaps that was a happy accident, because he set about forming what soon became a world-class ensemble, the Zagreb Soloists.
Unigro, of course, was playing chamber music with people of the calibre of Dino Lupati and Ginette Neveu. These were his coevals in Paris. And he was really playing with the very best people of his time. And so I think it was no coincidence that he, in the mid-50s, he started this amazing little orchestra.
And conducted them as well, didn't he?
Yes, he conducted and sometimes played solos. There was an absolute explosion of Italian chamber music playing, sparked off by my great hero Adolf Busch, who went to Florence in 35 with his little orchestra and caused a sensation. Also gave performances after the war with the La Scala ensemble and so on. And so you had I Virtuosi di Roma, you had I Musici, and in a sense the Zagreb soloists followed on from that. I think there were only 12 people in it, but they were hand-picked. And there's a great string-playing tradition in the Balkans, and and I think that they were just a great hit because they played with such pungencies. And it was called an orchestra of soloists, and it really was. But they were all listening to each other. He was listening to them, and they were listening to him as well.
Like Miloš Sadlo, Unigro also made a special study of the Bach suites. We hear him now in the prelude to Suite 3, direct muscular playing, a joy to listen to. Unigro continued to tour worldwide, although with his move back home to Milan in 1965, teaching and especially conducting began to take precedence, perhaps to the detriment of his memory as a cellist. Unigro was a true master of the instrument, and as one critic proclaimed, in his hands the cello never labours, never pants. Perhaps Unigro's most famous recording was his collaboration with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra and conductor Fritz Reiner on Richard Strauss's Don Quixote. Playing the part of the Don, Unigro vividly reimagined him lying in his bed, consumed with sadness and close to death. Unigro makes his cello speak the Don's final words with modesty and simplicity. He was exhaled, his great creator drew his spirit as the sun, the morning dew. The final cellist of my four underappreciated virtuosi is Leonard Rose. The exponent of an American school of playing that continues to flourish today, he was a master of elegance and restraint.
Leonard Rose is often known as a cellist's cellist. He excelled in practically every aspect of cello playing, as a teacher, a soloist, an orchestral cellist too, and a chamber musician.
Maybe this is my American perspective, but I do feel like Leonard Rose, in a way, defined American cello playing in a lot of ways. One of the great cello teachers, one of the great soloists, one of the great orchestral players, one of the great chamber musicians. A quintessential mid-20th century cellist.
He was certainly a peerless chamber musician, and as a 13-year-old, I had the privilege of seeing him play in his stellar trio with violinist Isaac Stern and pianist Eugene Istomin. He was the first American cellist to establish a global reputation, and his recordings have a timeless, unmannered quality that sound as fresh today as they did when first released. Above all, Rose was a disciplined musician. He once said, "The surest way to destroy a passionate sentiment in the score is to rush the tempo." He proves the point here with his measured statement of the opening of the last movement of Dvorak's concerto. Born in Washington in 1918, of Russian-Jewish parentage, cello playing ran in the Rose family. His father was a self-taught cellist. His cousin was Frank Miller, who for many years was principal cellist with the Chicago Symphony. And his half-brother Sam Stern was also a cellist based in Baltimore. At 10, Rose started cello lessons under Walter Grossman, who soon recognised that Rose would someday be famous. Tully Potter again.
Rose had come up through a very difficult school in the sense that he grew up in a place where there weren't many Jews and he experienced anti-Semitism. When he went to New York, he was much more at home, but he was a terribly competitive person, and I think this came from his father, who appeared with one hand to be encouraging him and with the other hand to be putting him down. And I think that Rose, as a result, was incredibly American in sort of going and getting things. He didn't wait for somebody to come to him.
Yes.
He was incredibly ambitious. And I think he represents really the New World approach.
Rose was one of Felix Salmon's students at the Curtis Institute, and he developed into an exemplary technician. Intertwined was a love of sound, which he compared with the way a painter thought of colour. No two reds, blues or greens should be the same. Kenneth Woods again.
Leonard Rose's sound is very compact, very focused and very intense. And it has a lot of reediness in it. That sounds like a bad thing, but it's a good thing. It's that ability to just get that sense that, you know, this is an instrument that's made of wood. And there are many great concerto recordings that show this ability to sort of project not with strength, but with tremendous intensity, tremendous articulation with the bow, but with focus and intensity. You really feel like he could imitate any letter in the alphabet with the beginning of a bow stroke. And Leonard Rose's sound was very well tailored to just cut its way through with the clarity with which he begins notes, with the edge that he puts in the sound, and the sort of rhythmic life that his playing has.
Let's hear Rose play the opening of Sammartini's Sonata, and how's this for direct, no-nonsense cello playing? graduating from Curtis, Rose joined Toscanini's NBC Orchestra in New York, and later the Cleveland Orchestra, where he made his debut with the Lalo Cello Concerto. But it was as principal cellist with the New York Philharmonic that Rose began to build his international career, which even the outbreak of war couldn't thwart.
During the Second World War, the story goes that Rose was called up by the army to take a physical exam in preparation for being drafted. Part of that process involved a psychiatric evaluation. And the psychiatrist who examined him recognised Rose as being the principal cellist of the New York Philharmonic at the time. And he proceeded to ask Rose a bunch of sort of made-up questions pertaining to his mental state. No matter what Rose answered to those questions, a red mark was made on his form. At the end of the examination, the doctor had made several red marks on his paper, which purposefully painted Rose as being psychologically unfit to serve in the military. And the doctor then is of course, reported to have said, "I think a guy like you should not be drafted. You're a young artist and you should go ahead and make your career." So it's amazing how one doctor who recognised Rose made a tremendous difference to his musical career.
Yet ironically, Rose was known to be extremely nervous before his concerts. But he was also the ultimate professional, as this string-breaking episode during a live broadcast of the Brahms Double Concerto shows.
Rose's A string broke just as he played the last of five chords with the violin in the first movement, as I remember. Fortunately, before a long orchestral tutti section. He had about 1 minute or 1 minute 10 seconds to solve this problem. He looked over at the lead cellist's cello and saw that he had with him his cheap, small English cello. And he decided he'd rather not use that. So he had a flash of inspiration. He leant over to him and whispered, "Quick, give me your A string." And amazingly, Rose managed to install the A string and tune his cello just before he had to come in. And the radio audience was none the wiser.
But it's possible that Rose's greatest achievement was as a teacher. His students from Curtis and Juilliard still grace every orchestra and conservatoire in America. And at one time, the cello section of the Boston Symphony Orchestra was known as the Rose section. And Rose taught both of today's most renowned American-based solo cellists, Lynn Harrell and Yo-Yo Ma. We've already heard that Rose was a master of cello tone. His own sound was described as being like a ribbon of spun gold. Leonard Rose with Brahms' F major sonata. Salmond, Sadlow, Unigro, Rose. Each one brought their own unique voice to the 20th century renaissance of the cello. And each one, through their distinguished pupils, has left a tangible legacy in terms of forging a path from one generation of cellists to the next. All four were superb cellists, who with the passing of time somehow seem to have been denied their rightful place in the cellistic hierarchy. Why should this be?
I think the public can only remember one or two people in any sphere at any given time.
So you don't think it is that there might be anything in the playing that just doesn't quite grab?
No, I think that if given their chance, these people are fantastic.
I think it's to do more than anything with our sort of cultural attention span. Their artistry would speak to anyone that listens. It's not something, you know, you have to know a secret handshake to appreciate Leonard Rose's sound or you know, be a particular sort of connoisseur type to love the work of Miloš Sadlo. These are great cellists who were working and living in the age of recording, who did leave a legacy that's out there. But in the ongoing sort of conversation, it's just always easiest, you know, if you're playing the Elgar Concerto on the radio, to grab Jackie Dupre's disc. And, well, it's stunning, you know. Once you put it on and you listen to it, you say, well, of course, that's why we play it. It's the best. But there's a lot of other voices out there.
Perhaps their record companies might have been more active in promoting the recordings of these wonderful artists. And perhaps some of their extraordinarily gifted pupils could have done more to keep the names of their mentors alive. Then again, all four cellists eschewed showmanship, preferring instead a restrained and dignified style of playing, in preference to theatrics and flamboyance. But whatever the reason, these cellists deserve to take their place, alongside the more famous 20th century masters.